Hello and welcome to The Energy Gang, a discussion show about the fast-moving world of energy. I'm Ed Crooks, and I'm joined today by Melissa Lott, who's a professor at the Climate School at Columbia University in New York. Hi, Melissa, how are you?
Hey, doing all right, Ed. How's your morning?
Very nice. Beautiful day here in New York City, isn't it? Really nice to be inside podcasting.
Not a good day. We should podcast outside, but the three of us are in New York.
Indeed, we should, actually. Yeah, that would be good fun. Just like, you know, you remember when you used to be in primary school, as it was for me, elementary school, I guess, in America, the teacher would say, look, it's a lovely day. Why don't we go and have the class outside? I always think about that. Great idea to be working outside whenever you can. And you've also heard there the voice of Amy Myers Jaffe, who's the director of the Energy, Climate Justice and Sustainability Lab at New York University. So also here in New York right now. Amy, how are you?
I'm great, Ed. Great to be here.
Yeah, well, great to have you back again. It's appropriate, I think, that we've just been talking about teaching because I want to start off with an inquiry into the meaning of words. Hopefully not a completely academic exercise, because I think there's some real practical relevance to this. But I want to think about the words we use when we talk about the energy transition. We use those words all the time. I think we all know what we mean when we use those words, but they are definitely not universally accepted. Some people really don't like the term. I remember I once heard someone from the oil and gas industry describe it as hate speech. I mean, that's a joke, right? But I think there is a real issue there. When you talk about the transition, people say, are we really transitioning if we are having an energy transition from what to what? And I think it is a term that we use often quite unthinkingly without necessarily pinning down exactly what's going on. Exhibit A, I suppose, in the argument against talking about the energy transition is the persistence of fossil fuels in the global energy system. If you think about where fossil fuels were 20 years ago, they were maybe 80-85% of the world's primary energy, depending on how exactly you define it. Look at them today, they're a bit less than that, but maybe only a few percentage points less than that. So if there is a transition, it seems to have been happening until now very slowly. So to use perhaps a bit of academic jargon, I think it's helpful to interrogate the way we talk about the energy transition and to see whether actually the language that we use is leading us into blind alleys and is perhaps confusing us to the reality of what's really happening. Amy, maybe to start with you on this, I know this is something you've been thinking about. What do you think? Are we misleading ourselves? Are we deluding ourselves when we use that term energy transition so readily?
You know, I tell people I spend a lot of my time, especially if I have to give a talk to a traditional energy convention or meeting, where I go in and I say, listen, you have this meme, and let's talk about the actual data. So one of the memes of the traditional energy industry is that we've never had an energy transition. We just add forms of energy because there are still people in the world who are burning wood, and so therefore we've never transitioned away from wood. I mean, it's absolutely true that the UN has the Sustainable Development Goals, and one of the big challenges is to move people away from wood and traditional biomass, no question. But to say that we never transitioned from wood till today is a ridiculous, ridiculous point. So what I would say, and I like to quote my colleague, Kelly Sims Gallagher from the Fletcher School at Tufts, she had a great piece out in Foreign Affairs just this week, where she talked about how this sort of climate doom and gloom really disregards the progress that's been made. And she makes a couple of points, all of which are amazingly true. You know, one which we've talked about many times before, which is the falling cost of renewables. But she has the statistics, which is that 56 countries have passed direct climate mandates to limit greenhouse gases. So that's 53% of global emissions are under legal sanction. And then she makes the other point that, you know, it's not like there's no countries in the world whose emissions have peaked, because people like to point out, you know, what's happening in a China or in India. But, you know, ultimately, you know, the United States, the UK, Australia, Japan, Norway, EU, Jamaica, South Africa, Gabon, Panama, these are all countries whose emissions are on a downward trajectory. And indeed, Thermal coal generation in the United States was down an additional 20% in 2023 and still falling. And China's coal plants, which people talk about a lot, are unbelievably operating at an incredibly low capacity factor. And indeed, China has agreed to stop financing coal in the developing world. So it's not like we're not making any progress. And Kelly didn't even mention my pet thing, which is that 49 countries have a price on carbon. And some additional countries that are very important, like Brazil, India, Indonesia, are looking at carbon pricing cap and trade regulations. So, you know, to say that there's no energy transition and we're not making any progress, and, you know, this is just like, first they tried to kill ESG, and that was easy because there were some black box programs that funds were offering and they really didn't work. And so therefore people didn't make money. But, you know, now when you're talking about the energy transition, because people shifted from saying they had an ESG fund to saying they had an energy transition fund, because that was uncontroversial. So now you've got this attack on the words energy transition. And that's just ridiculous. I mean, we can see the technology explosion. I think the statistic, I don't know, Melissa, you might know better than I think the statistic for what percentage of new generation capacity in the past year came from renewables was overwhelming. Like, I don't know if it was 90, 100%, something like that. It was a really high number.
Yeah, I mean, overall on renewables, no doubt it's booming. No doubt that a lot of technologies that definitely 20 years ago, well, 20-ish years ago plus, when I started work in this field, you know, they were not as competitive as they are today. No doubt. We all know those things. Cost decline's a big thing. It's interesting hearing what you're saying, Amy, because I get in so many discussions about should it be energy transition or energy transformation, like what actually is honoring the urgency with which we need to move if we are going to respond to climate change. And so, yes, renewables are booming. They're going full out. But what I just said is not enough for solving climate change. Everything needs to go faster, and we need to bend emissions. So we need to not also be building out new emissions intensive resources at quick paces. So, you know, getting around the different words, the transition or transformation, pick your favorite. The transition, though, is happening already because new technologies are competitive in the market. So, you know, in the past, we've seen transitions from, you know, systems that were dominated by wood to being dominated by fossil fuels to having significant portions of nuclear. The transformation bit of it, I'll say, is not quite there yet. You know, the speed and scale that we need to solve climate change, we are not there yet. And that's just following the data. But back to your very, very opening piece, Amy, around it, like the doomerism, one thing that I think it is so easy to focus on what we aren't doing, and to Kelly's point, to your point, we're doing a lot. And we have accomplished so much more than when I was running models at the International Energy Agency that I thought we were going to likely get to. Do we need more? Absolutely. But we are seeing big, big, big shifts in the system.
And I think the oil companies are under threat, and I'll tell you why. This week, the UN negotiations on plastics pollution started making real progress on putting a global treaty together that would put a cap and then an eventual decline in the production of plastics. And in this debate about the plastics treaty, you have corporates weighing in. So you've got a Unilever and a Walmart, companies that have strong sustainability platforms weighing in favor of this plastics treaty. And then you have, you know, ExxonMobil and other big petrochemical producers weighing in against. And of course, on the international stage, you've got countries that are major petrochemical exporters that have not been supportive. But the targets are pretty ambitious. You've got environmental groups saying that there should be a 75% reduction from 2019 levels by 2040 in plastics production. So maybe, I don't know how realistic that is with recycling and a commitment and so forth, but, you know, you have a lot of movement in that area. And that was an area where the oil industry was counting on having increasing demand.
Yeah. And so double click on that point. If you look at future scenarios for conventional energy producers, for fossil fuel producers, and okay, so yes, transportation is shifting. We get that, you know, road transport in particular. Okay. We're expecting to see declines, certainly in projections, if nothing else, and then in absolute numbers overall. But okay, chemicals and petrochemicals and industry more broadly, plastics included, we're actually expecting to see booming demand in some pieces of it. What is it, going back to development, and when you look at development numbers and, you know, as countries and regions develop, you see kind of a saturation point when it comes to steel and cement. Okay, you just don't need anymore because the buildings are built and the roads are there and you're repairing, but that's, yeah. But plastics, if you go back to there's this episode of The Big Switch I did with Rebecca Dell, oh goodness, a couple of years ago. And she was like, we don't have a saturation point that we know of with plastics. It just keeps going up and up and up. And so if you've been depending on that and then suddenly it might not be there, that is not a small deal. That is potentially game-changing if you think that is going to happen or if you think there's a high probability of it. But Ed, Amy and I have been going back and forth, and we could do this for an hour, and I want to know what you think on everything we just said. Go into the words. What do you think?
Yeah, absolutely. I am very keen to get back into it. And I want to put a pin in that plastics discussion because I think that's really important, but I want to come back to that because I think it's somewhat distinct from the conversation about energy and the energy transition. I have to say, Melissa, that was new to me, that terminology, energy transformation.
Really?
I hadn't heard that before. That's an interesting addition to my vocabulary. I mean, it feels like, though, still, it's totally unrealistic to be talking about transformation when we're not even clear that there is a transition. And I have some sympathy for the language that says what we're actually seeing is energy addition. And in particular, I have some sympathy for the thought that as new sources of energy emerge, they will be used, and to the extent that they are cleaner and cheaper and so on, their growth will be faster. But there is still enormous unmet demand for energy services in the world. There's still going to be huge growth in demand for energy. And I take your point totally, Amy, about wood is clearly going to be on its way out, should be replaced. It causes terrible problems. Millions of people dying because of pollution caused by wood burning and so on. And the sooner we can get rid of that, the better. But as a counter argument, what about coal? Everyone thinks of coal as the great energy source of the 19th century, maybe the 20th century. Coal demand in the world right now is higher than it has ever been and probably is kind of plateauing, maybe leveling out, but certainly does not look like it's going to fall off a cliff anytime soon. And so the growth in renewables and so on that we're seeing at the moment is being added to that colossal demand for coal. Same with oil, right? Oil demand has been rising steadily, may well have a bit more growth in it. Again, probably will plateau maybe in the next decade or so, but is not collapsing either. So when you look at all those trends, that is just energy addition, isn't it? That's not a real transition.
So let me push back on it a little bit, Ed, because somebody made this point over Twitter this week that when you look at primary energy instead of downstream, you don't get the right picture because the technologies that use primary energy, like the ones you're talking about, like coal and oil, have a lot of waste heat and don't use the energy they produce efficiently. And I just hosted Akshat Rathi at NYU, and you know, he has his new book out, and you know, he made a diagram up on the whiteboard for the students who were there for book club. And you know, he showed how the formula for how much more energy efficient and use of the energy an EV is compared to an IC engine car, where 80% of the energy that's coming out of your tank is wasted. So I like to make this correction to people. You know, coal's a little harder, and I talk about that in a minute. But when people are talking about energy security or how renewables are too expensive for the developing world, they have to stick with, you know, fossil fuels. The truth is that if you don't actually have your own oil or your own natural gas, then the volatility of those prices is quite extreme. And actually, you'd be better off with renewables, where you kind of like know what your conditions are going to be. Once you put it in, you have price certainty, right? So I think there's a lot of discussion about what data am I using to make this point. A lot of the models that project forward primary energy demand, you know, I've talked about this in the past, they have climate change at 5 degrees warming, and they don't make any acknowledgement to the fact that economic progress would be damaged under those circumstances. So Swiss Re did their own forecast, and they show that under a 3.2 degrees warming scenario, 25% of Asian GDP disappears by 2050, basis the comparison with a 1.5 degrees or a 2 degrees scenario. So these projections about the future are all based on the idea that we can just have unlimited climate change and it won't dent at all our use of oil. And that's just completely incorrect.
Yeah. And I'll say on part of these things, the question of, are we in a transition? Are we not in a transition? Are we moving faster? Are we doomed? Or should we be optimistic? All these questions. I know offline, we've all had versions of this discussion. And I think we were talking about the other day, which is a transition to what and by when? Because when I'm in a country that doesn't even have existing infrastructure, there's an issue with the word transition, because like, transitioning from what? I mean, I'm transitioning to having energy. Does that count? And then are we talking about trying to meet the Paris Climate Agreement, or are we talking about something else? Because transitions are happening because solar, wind, storage, other things are outcompeting the traditional fuel sources. Let's look at power, coal, and a lot of the world. That's just happening. That's competition. Transitions are happening because competition is, you know, in different forms already happening, and those things are winning out.
Thank you to the Russians. The thing that's getting squeezed is natural gas.
And so there's all these geopolitical forces to what Amy just said. There's a lot going on. So the question is, are we all actually on the same page that when we say energy transition, we're talking about net zero targets on a Paris timeline? Or are we just talking about broader trends that are happening in the energy system? And I will say we use the term very interchangeably. And as someone who, okay, academic moment at just for a minute, I teach energy literacy in my class. The words we use do matter, back to your opening point, and how we use them, and we don't all use them the same. And it's important to tease these things out when we're having discussions about what happens next, because you can get into a conversation and think you're on the exact same page, and you absolutely are not.
And then let's talk about transition as a word, because if demand that would normally have gone to natural gas is actually going to solar and batteries or wind, is that not a transition? It would have been gas in the old world.
Well, and so this goes back to transitions. When gas got really cheap, when we figured out how to frack, and all of a sudden it was much more competitive, and those, you know, 13s I put into my models became 2s, or, you know, 1 and changes. I mean, these are big shifts, and you started seeing different stuff get built than what had gotten built in the past. But I think that it is important fundamentally, if we take this up about 15 stories or maybe 30 stories, to say the energy system is in a transition, and maybe at least the following ways. We now have a system that is on track to become increasingly electrified. Electricity is on track. Forget Paris Climate Agreements for a moment. Just increasingly electrified because we have options that make sense for a lot of people. And so it starts playing a bigger role. We also have seen, despite all the progress we still need to see, we have seen a lot of progress in the past decade or two around getting more people connected to energy systems, more people having access to modern energy systems. Yes, the past few years have been rough, so I'm not discounting that, but we have seen that happening. And we are having a system that was built on burn stuff to boil stuff to create steam to make electricity, to actually having variable renewables where it's a much more direct path with a different type of fuel source that's either there or not, that isn't easy to ship around. You got to do a lot to ship it around. And like, at least for the power system, which is where my first home in the energy system was, these are big deals. These are really big deals to not just be dealing with kind of firm 24/7 power and balancing with demand, to moving to a much more complex system with a lot of different characteristics.
So big announcement was made this week, and it is a little bit terminology, okay? So California apparently has gone 38 straight days where at least for a minute they were at 100% renewables. And, you know, I think the point was made, well, even though if it's just for an hour or two, people said it was like impossible to ever do 100% renewables even for an hour or two. And so here you have a whole month where that happened in a particular place that has very progressive climate policy. And so some people are saying, you know, hey, that's a landmark.
Yeah, I don't disagree, because I remember in early modeling days, you know, it was like, oh, what's the system going to do at 10%? Oh, we pushed it to 30. And some people thought we were just out of our minds. You know, they're like, what are you doing? If you did that for any moment in time, much less a day or something, that would be crazy. And now I'm looking in so many grids, it's actually so many have developed grids, it's kind of standard, par for the course, you're doing that. So this can cut both ways. You know, one, the data don't support us not being optimistic when it comes to solving climate change. We have so many technologies, all the stuff we talked about before, we can make progress, especially if we're willing to lean into the non-technical barriers, build out the supply chains we need, et cetera. But that's a decision that we, the world, has to make. But within all of these things, I do think a dose of reality where, yes, we hit all these records around renewables, and that's awesome, and we should be optimistic. That does not mean we're at the speed and scale we need if transition means being aligned with Paris. The numbers just aren't there yet. So we need more effort very quickly to get there.
Right, absolutely. Which brings me to another question I think is really interesting about language and the way we talk about these issues, which is something that really hit me, Amy, when we were at NYU speaking on the panel a few weeks ago, where I was on the panel with Vijay Vaiseswaran from The Economist. Your colleague, Amy Carolyn Kissane, was asking questions then. And one of the questions she asked was, is there a chance of reaching net zero emissions globally by around 2050 to put us on that pathway to limit global warming to 1.5 degrees centigrade? Is there still any chance of that happening? And I don't want to put words in Vijay's mouth. I can't remember exactly how he answered it, but we were basically saying the same thing, which was, it's technically possible, maybe, but in view of all the political and economic issues that are out there, for all practical purposes, it is impossible. It's not going to happen. We should not be expecting that that's going to be an achievable pathway for the world, and we should realize that. And obviously, this is quite a tough message to give to people, but my own feeling is we need to accept that as a reality and think about what that means and move on from there. Anyway, so this is what we said on the panel. We were then sort of chatting afterwards informally, and several people came up to me and to Vijay afterwards and said, really interesting, I thought it was fascinating what you said about 1.5 degrees, because we work for businesses, companies, organizations that are not allowed to say that. We still have to present the idea that 1.5 degrees is still alive. We maybe even have corporate strategies aligned with a 1.5 degree goal. And this is something still making decisions to align with based on that possibility that this Paris goal is still achievable. And I thought that was really striking, just the sense that they'll want to retain 1.5 degrees as a goal. And I think we talked about this on the show recently as well, and it was Samantha Gross from the Brookings Institution. And the point she made was, it's hard to abandon 1.5 degrees as an objective, because if you say that's not now the goal anymore, but hey, we've got this new goal and this one we really mean and this one we are going to stick to even though we didn't one, then you have a real credibility problem. But I do wonder, given everything that we've been saying now about, yes, all the real progress, but the pace being an issue, whether it is time to change the way we talk about Paris and our progress towards meeting those goals. Melissa, you raised the subject. What do you think?
So, Ed, when you're saying all this, I'm curious, Amy, in a moment, what you think through. But my mind immediately goes to this very interesting thing, which is the social license to operate part of this, and how when you look at the history of social movements and how quickly and profoundly they can change systems. Where, okay, what did you say? These companies, they're not allowed to talk about not hitting 1.5 and they have to align their targets with it. Well, why? Because there are pressures in this system that are so profound, they are worried about negative impacts on their businesses. That's one of the major reasons why. So you want social license to operate? You can't say, I'm giving up on this goal. You can't be the one to do that. You have to plan around meeting it and align everything with that. And going back to what's happening this year at the political level and how many people are going through major elections and how many countries, more than 50 now, right, that have like binding climate legislation to get emissions down. And then Amy, you were talking about it. It's a similar number when it comes to countries that have like carbon pricing in some form, you know, going on at some level. I mean, this is a very different playing field. And when you look at progress made to date, I don't know that it is an exceptional indicator of progress that we expect to see in the future, because one of the tipping points in this transition, I'll just use that word for now, is the social tipping points. So as a company, okay, what happens when they walk away from this? They expect harm to their business because they expect people to then call them out as if they're not working towards the goal. That's some serious social pressure that these companies are feeling.
Well, and let me just add to that, I don't think they'll be successful, but there's a giant shareholder movement afoot right now to remove Darren Woods as the chairman of ExxonMobil, even though ExxonMobil has been adding a lot of commitment to new technology. So I do think that we have to recontextualize. I was at a conference this week in Washington, D.C., hosted by the Center for International and Strategic Studies, and the whole conversation in this spectrum was on European security, but people from Europe and also the United States Biden administration were there, and some corporates, and a lot of discussion was about how the crisis in Europe, given the war in Ukraine, has really shaped how governments look at energy. And indeed, you know, the point was made that it's not just Europe, that that crisis affected India, affected Pakistan, affected, you know, many countries where there were blackouts in those countries because of the disruption to LNG. And people feel that that was really a turning point, you know, maybe even more than the Paris Accord, because governments are now heavily involved in energy markets across the world in a way that markets, markets, markets would have been the mantra, you know, just 10 years before. And this shift to strong government hand in energy, I think, lends itself to a changed pace, even if it doesn't look like it's going to be a successful meeting in Azerbaijan, yes or no. I think the point is governments are intervening in energy markets. You have a lot of money being thrown at technology. And just to give you an idea, in Washington, you know, the president just signed something to say that the Chinese company can't own TikTok in the United States, right? So there's a lot of this, you know, what about supply chain stability? And people at the conference literally suggested, which I'd actually written in a foreign affairs piece, so it was interesting to me. I wrote it in 2021 and I was probably like heckled behind my back. But people literally said that the way to handle Chinese overcapacity in solar panels, in batteries, and some of these things that are coming out to market is that governments should buy those materials while they're cost effective and stockpile them, right? And we should have a DER lithium material stockpile. Governments should put these together so that our commitment to climate change can move forward with the energy transition without concerns about supply chain disruption.
And so it's interesting, I will say, fast forwarding to what we've seen in the last 2 weeks in terms of series of announcements that have come out in this country from the Biden administration, different pockets of it. Those issues, I mean, Amy, I'm with you. I remember authoring and being a part of critical materials, critical minerals, critical infrastructure, you know, task forces and whatever. Yeah, about a decade or so now. But now, in the run-up to the election, I mean, Earth Week from the Biden administration, that's a rollout of a lot of stuff. And it's interesting for a lot of different reasons, including the fact that it is showing how pushing after the Inflation Reduction Act got passed to get money out the door before this next election is complete, whatever that looks like, what it's manifesting in terms of impacts, especially in marginalized, low-income, disadvantaged communities. But also, there was that announcement that happened actually by John Podesta a week and a half ago here on campus, where he said, hey, I'm announcing this climate and trade part of the conversation. We need to be thinking about this. So your supply chain comment, Amy, it's just, how are we thinking about trade? How are we thinking about getting to net zero? Because it can't be any person by themselves. You know, how do we do this collectively, collaboratively around the globe?
And there were a lot of calls at the conference that I was at for better European and U.S. collaboration on supply chains, that where everybody's kind of going their own way. Even within Europe, you got countries going their own way. And there was a lot of discussion about the fact that this trade thing needs to get coordinated and we need to have more cooperation across allied nations on these issues.
It's an exciting time for solar. Advancements in tech, policy support, investment, and the decentralization of solar promise a bright future for the industry. Tax credits are driving investment, and large projects across many U.S. states are grabbing headlines. On The Interchange, we dive deep into the technology and financing that's driving solar growth. We've been joined by industry leaders and experts on the show over the past couple years, and we're back this year to do it again. We'll be in San Francisco on the 12th and 13th of June at Wood Mackenzie's Solar and Energy Storage Summit. As always, I'll be bringing you the debates, conversations, and insights from the industry's leading event right here on the podcast. To secure your ticket, visit woodmac.com/events and subscribe to The Interchange so you don't miss the special episodes coming in June. Look forward to seeing you there.
Yeah, so let's talk about that John Podesta announcement, as you say, Melissa, which you made on campus at Columbia last week. So basically what, I mean, this is a sort of the launch of a task force, I think he called it, something like a White House task force, which is looking at climate and trade very specifically, right? And it's thinking about basically how climate and trade policies work together. I don't know. I mean, I think that's a fantastic idea. The idea of a strategic solar panel reserve or a strategic battery reserve is a really interesting thought. Not sure if that's something which is going to get onto their agenda. But essentially, the Biden administration is thinking about this question of something we talked about on the show before, massive Chinese overcapacity in solar modules, in lithium-ion batteries, in EVs, and so on, and saying, what, how do we address that? How do we make sure that we can both take advantage of the benefits of that when it exists, but also avoid the threats that it presents to our industries in the US? Is that what they're thinking about? Well, what's your understanding, Melissa, of where they're going with this?
So when I read through it, I mean, you can go through his formal remarks because they're online or you can watch the video, but I'm just going to quote it. So we need a race to the top for climate action, a global trading system that slashes pollution, creates a fair and level playing field, protects against carbon dumping, supports good manufacturing jobs and economic opportunity, and rewards every country that's doing the right thing, no matter their stage of development. And so what is that? That's like carbon border adjustments on steroids. That's thinking about how do we set up trade rules to acknowledge things. And by things, I mean pollution and greenhouse gas emissions. And, you know, not every bit of steel is exactly the same. Not every bit of aluminum is exactly the same, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And every battery has the same footprint. So how do we acknowledge that so that there's a market mechanism, in this case, a trade tool that recognizes those who are investing in things that are aligned with climate priorities. But around this, it's interesting on the timing, and it's interesting that it's coming out right now. And it highlights something that, I mean, what is it when the Inflation Reduction Act got put out? There was like a translating lots of feedback the U.S. was getting. Yes, we wanted you to have bold climate action, but we didn't really want it done that way. That was some of the feedback that came in, you know, and all these industrial policies that create mechanisms for spurring growth in different industries. Okay, well, now you're spurring growth in industries and you're getting into a very competitive trade-based system. What do you do? And how do you make sure that, yes, there is a level playing field? I will make one brief comment and then I'm really interested what y'all thought about that announcement and the related ones. But I think it is also a reflection of the times and where the science has advanced to the point where we can actually monitor so much stuff remotely from space. Go back to that report. It's just such a good title by my colleagues here at Columbia, Nowhere to Hide when it comes to methane emissions, because we've got technologies that it's like, okay, tell me what you think you're doing, but I can use this remote technology to see what I think you're doing and we can go from there. So I think it's an advancement in what we're able to do in terms of monitoring and verification as well. So, okay, what do you guys think?
Okay, well, I'll jump in. The Democrats have been working on this bill since 2023 called the Clean Competition Act. And it's like the American version of the carbon border adjustment. Same idea. It's designed to ensure that if Americans are doing this manufacturing and American companies are doing things to lower their emissions, that they don't get beaten out by competitors that are, as we call it, dumping carbon into the global system. So there is actually even activity on the Hill in that domain. It's not just coming out of the White House. It's something that the Congress is looking at.
Yeah, so just a quick footnote for anyone who might not know what the carbon border adjustment mechanism is. This is a policy that was introduced in Europe last year, which essentially is taxing imports based on their carbon content, and in particular their sort of unpriced carbon content. So if you're importing some goods into the EU that's already paid a carbon price when it was being produced, then you may be able to get away without paying this import duty. But if there's no carbon price in the source country, then you'll have to pay an amount which essentially is going to be equivalent to the carbon price in the EU under the EU's emissions trading system. So, as you're saying, it's basically the idea is a level playing field so that you can't get what sometimes is called carbon dumping, countries that are just letting their carbon pollution run wild, not trying to control it at all, then taking advantage of the lower costs in order to be able to sell their products cheaply into the EU, and the idea is to stop that with this carbon border adjustment mechanism. So, I mean, what you both seem to be saying is that we're moving towards having one of those in the US as well. Do you think it's likely that's going to be introduced here at some time in the next few years?
I mean, it's possible the election will matter, but if you look at the bottom line, one of the things the Biden administration is rushing out the door is the $6 billion in funding for companies that want to tackle innovation to go after industrial emissions. So, you know, cement, steel, et cetera. And they're really substantive projects. You know, in addition to the hydrogen hubs, you have other demonstration projects that are getting federal support. And, you know, again, since everybody's reading language here, this bill that I'm mentioning in the U.S., for too long, American industries producing goods in a less carbon-intensive way have been undercut by competitors with dirtier production processes, .. The Clean Competition Act would impose a fee on imports from high carbon-emitting producers.
Right. So actually, that's exactly the same idea as behind the European policy.
Exactly. So I guess I'm not such a close kill watcher to, you know, how feasible is it? But Ed, we've all discussed this question about which of the states that are getting, I mean, I agree with Melissa, the Biden administration is pushing money out the door because it's just unknown. You know, people care about these policies. The companies who want the incentives. And the idea is if the money's already appropriated, it can't be disappropriated. So the question is, if we're already doing that and there starts to be a critical mass of companies in the United States on both sides of the aisle in red states and blue states that are benefiting and want to be protected, I think what would have seemed virtually impossible, which is to have some kind of a trade fee like this, could in the end gain momentum, even though there seems to be political pushback against quote-unquote ESG or environmental policies. It might be hard, even for a Republican-led Congress fully across the Senate and the House, if that were to happen, it might be hard for them to push back against these industries that are receiving these federal funds and already have the funds out the door from the Biden administration.
And I'll say, if you look at the task force that Podesta announced, it had three big things. First, develop a climate and trade policy toolkit. And they highlighted, you know, what it needed to address, but they flagged they were open to, you know, creative ways to create policies that would achieve those goals. The second was about data, so making sure there was data to actually help with the implementation. And the third thing, and I'll just quote it, is that the task force will identify what more we can do at home and abroad to further position producers to thrive in this new race to the top environment. And this is the idea of flagging goes, what is it? Whatever stage of development you're in, you know, race to the top. Like, how are we supporting producers? So that to me is a big flag for demand side mechanisms. How are we actually creating the markets that are needed to say, hey, when you build that stuff, there will be someone to pay you for it and pay you how much you need to be paid.
Ed, I already made this point on the show that you referred to with Vijay, which is that if there are going to be just more and more cheap Chinese electric vehicles, the idea that somehow Americans, if we had some crisis in the Middle East or elsewhere, and the price of oil went way back up and gasoline prices went up in this country, the idea that people would stick with their ICE engine cars in the face of being able to buy an incredibly cheap Chinese EV, I'm not so sure Americans would make that choice. And indeed, the big controversy, another big controversy this week was the Elon Musk investor call. And he said, well, I'm focused on robo-taxis. And I got to tell you, I can't remember the last time I, you know, hit my button on my phone to get someone to drive me to the airport and they didn't come and pick me up in a Tesla. Like, it's just been universally Teslas.
So sorry, what do you conclude from that, Lim? And do you think the robo-taxi is real then?
I don't know. I wrote about robo-taxis in my book, and I still believe in my heart in robo-taxis, but it really takes urban planning because you're going to have to, in the beginning, have dedicated robo-taxi lanes because of the inability to car companies, you know. People say that this thing about AI, that there's some usages where get 90% is good enough, especially if you're doing a paper for my class and you're going to use it. I always tell students, like, I'm going to check you, so make sure that you check this information to make sure it's actually accurate. But for
road safety, it's not.
Yeah. Road safety has to be 100%. And Tesla has not yet shown that it can do 100%. So I don't know what to make of that announcement, but the fact that they're focused on the fact that they're selling their cars to people who are shared ride drivers is, I think, an acknowledgement of an interesting trend. And Elon Musk is sending, you know, rockets to space. So I don't want to count them out 100% if they're going to really, really focus on robo-taxis. Like, are they going to get there next year? Probably not. But could they get there? Maybe, especially if they work together with a city like New York City or LA, where you could have a dedicated lane for those vehicles. I think they could get there.
Yeah, that is a very interesting thought. Now, I want to get back then to the Biden administration's announcements, though, because I think it's worth just thinking about what their strategy is. As we've been saying, this absolute barrage of announcements have been coming out over the past week or so, particularly this week, because it's been Earth Week. Just scrolling down the list a bit here. So we've got, as you say, the John Podesta announcement on climate and trade that we've been talking about, two initiatives for accelerating grid connections for renewables, $7 billion in grants for solar, limits to oil and gas development in Alaska, blocking a mining road in Alaska. That's an interesting decision because I think that mine could produce copper and other metals essential for the energy transition, but the road to serve it is getting blocked, so that's not going to happen, and raises that whole debate about other environmental issues being traded off against climate policy. They've also then just past couple of days been talking about net zero goal for freight transport emissions, and also literally just today, as we're recording this, I don't know if you had a chance to look at it, but the EPA has published their final rule on power plant emissions, which basically is saying that if you want to run a coal plant after 2039, you're going to have to fit carbon capture equipment to it by 2032. So on a really tight timetable, given how that sort of post-combustion technology for carbon capture is still very much in its infancy and is struggling at the moment despite all the attempts to get it off the ground and the 45Q tax credit it can get and so on. That looks like a very, very demanding timetable to actually get coal plants to comply with that regulation. And it's clear there's going to be a big legal fight over it. And if you remember the last set of power plant regulations that the Obama administration introduced, in the end got struck down by the Supreme Court back in 2022. So clearly there's lots of specific issues with these individual announcements. Taking a step back, though, and thinking about what the Biden administration's strategy is, it seems to me like they are trying to have a very concerted effort to show that they are doing something on climate. The other context I thought for this, which was pretty kind of amazing, was a poll from CBS News and YouGov talking about Americans' perceptions of climate policy. Climate change, is climate change an important issue? So 45% of Americans said climate change is a very important issue. However, of the respondents who said that they thought climate change was a critical issue, only 10% had either heard a lot or read a lot about what the Biden administration has done to address it. So it does seem like they've got a big messaging and communications problem in terms of kind of conveying to people what they've been doing, and obviously they have been doing an enormous amount, particularly through the Inflation Reduction Act, which I guess then is maybe unfortunate branding as a bit of climate legislation because of that name, nothing to do with climate and energy. But what do you think then, when you think about what we're seeing over the past few days, how do you read the administration's strategy? Amy, what do you think?
Well, I don't want to be a gossip.
No, please do.
So Al Gore has founded this really wonderful project called the Climate Reality Project. They had a meeting in mid-April that was training people for climate leadership. And John Podesta was a guest speaker on stage with Al Gore and some apparently very effective climate activists got on stage and were very unhappy with the administration's approach to climate change. And so you have this reality that for some segment of the Democratic base, the Biden administration is not doing enough. I mean, we're at record oil production, record oil exports, a thriving liquefied natural gas industry. And then you have a segment that's still really unhappy with how the Biden administration made a compromise in Alaska on the Willow Project and forced the companies to give up the possibility of drilling on a lot of land in favor of approving a permit that was already issued and would take a long litigation to block. People are still really unhappy with that decision. And the president is the president of all Americans. So sometimes, you know, you talk about what a words mean. For some people on the progressive left, when you're talking about just transition, we're talking about making sure that underserved communities, fence line communities, tribal communities are participating in the gains that are coming from clean energy and federal investment in clean energy. When you talk about just transition in some oil producing and coal producing regions, we're talking about making sure that people are taken care of and that they maintain their jobs or their standard of living, or these states are able to still have sufficient revenues to provide public services that were previously funded by, you know, oil and gas royalties and so forth. So even that word just transition has different meanings to different people. And the president is president of all Americans. And so he has to really cater to both those communities. And then, of course, you know, I mentioned at the top of the show that I was at a conference on European security. And so the role of President Trump's term freedom molecules in helping out Europe is not lost on people from Europe. So this balancing act that the administration has had to take between making sure we have energy security in Europe today and making sure that we have a just transition for traditional energy communities and making sure that the United States is supplying enough energy to the world while we're gearing up in climate technology has been one that's made the president unpopular, probably with everyone.
There's so many threads I want to pull right now, but I'm realizing we don't have enough time to go down the rabbit holes on all of them. So I'll just say something briefly, which is, yes, I think there's a communication gap. The number of people I talk to who think the Inflation Reduction Act has to do with banks or something else, like, you know, as opposed to it being this massive energy and climate legislation, massive, is still interesting to encounter. But beyond that, so there's a communications gap there. I'm not disagreeing with you, Ed. But beyond that, I also do think there is some degree of reflection of where the bar has been set now for what constitutes enough action and enough movement. And there is a growing constituency, and it's not just here on campus and in my classroom, who are saying, you know, we need to move faster. We have waited so long. We need to move faster. And so what is significant? So I'm going to go back to your first question of the show, Ed, which is, let's get into the words. What is enough? What is significant? What is major? What do these things mean? And they mean different things to each of us.
Yeah, that is a great point. And as you say, brings us right back to the discussion we started with. I promised we'd come back to the plastics issue. Just one thing I wanted to say very quickly about that. I have a big problem with this whole debate on the grounds that put hydrocarbons into plastics, they are not so much of a problem for the climate, right? You're locking up the carbon in plastic. Obviously, in time, eventually it degrades and gets into the environment, but it takes a long time. Plastic pollution clearly is a problem, but also there are undoubtedly lots of ways in which plastic can help address climate change. Packaging can help, you know, preventing food waste, lots of plastic components in low carbon energy technologies, in your EVs, whatever it might be. The idea of, in particular, of putting kind of hard limits on the amount of plastic that gets produced in the world, I am far from convinced of the merit of that thought. Possibly something we should come back to and debate in more detail on another show.
Well, I'm going to debate you, Ed.
I was going to say, I can see you shaking your head, Amy.
I've got people at NYU who are working on what we call sustainable petrochemicals. So we're going to do a whole show on that.
I'm going to say one quick thing because I can't let it go. Do you see my eyebrow go up where I'm like, hey, okay, but there are trade-offs to that. So yes, they help with these things, but by producing them, we have these other trade-offs. What are our options and what trade-offs are we willing to accept? I want to open up this box, but yeah. New show, next discussion. But yeah, there's so much to unpack there, Ed.
Fair point. And we should definitely get into it. And it's a great topic for a future show. I'm just going to give myself the right of last word, though, just to say that plastic straw environmentalism, I do think, is a great term for kind of gestural stuff that has very, very little real impact. And I think it's worth thinking about the whole strategy to do with plastics in that context.
Ed, why are you doing this at the end of the show?
Okay, so if everyone can just clear their diaries and book in for another 2 hours.
I'm using my free electron on this. I'm just telling you that right now.
I promise we can come back to it. Right. Anyway, yeah, so free electrons then. What do you got?
Okay, I'm doing my free electron while I've got everybody's attention on the subject of plastics. So last year, I'm a climate communicator for the U.S. government, and they sent me at an invitation of the Italian government and industry to do a tour on sustainable fashion. And so I had to collect the data. So let me just share with you the following data. First of all, if the fashion industry was a country, they would be the fourth largest emitter in the world after the United States, China, and India. Two-thirds of all textiles that are used by the fabric industry contain plastic. So I asked people rhetorically, like, how much oil petrochemicals in your clothes would you feel comfortable sleeping in? Do you understand how much oil you are sleeping in next to your skin, right? And a lot of that microplastic, because that's what we call it microplastic, so it sounds less bad. I forget the statistic, but like that represents like 10 or 20 or 30% of the microplastic pollution in the ocean, which is ingested, Ed, by the food you are eating. And then you are digesting microplastics from your own clothes, which absolutely could be made without plastics, right? So I just want to like level set. That is my free electron. And fast fashion is 50% of that trend. So I've committed myself to no more fast fashion. It's very hard. You know, I'm working in Manhattan and I walk by to name names, H&M or some store like that. And I have to just put blinders on and say, it doesn't matter. I have clothes that look nice. I'm going to wear them.
It's a great subject for a future show as well. That whole issue of clothes. And in particular, I think your point about fast fashion, you make a lot of good points. I would just say, though, related to synthetic fibers, if you get your clothes made out of cotton instead, they use a lot more energy and a lot more water. So it's absolutely not clear to me that those synthetic fibers are worse. But
next year at our Christmas episode, I'll be sending you a mushroom-based leather jacket, Ed. Just saying. Because that exists.
That does sound unmissable. That I very much look forward to. Anyway, we'll come back to that next time. For now, Melissa, what's your free electron?
Have you both been to Riyadh? Amy, you've been to Riyadh, right?
And
you-
I have, yeah.
Well, soon it's going to be 3 for 3 because I'm making my first trip to Riyadh. So I've been in the region before, but I haven't been to Saudi Arabia before. I work with a lot of folks over the years from CAPSARC, the research center there, but I haven't gone myself, but I'm going for the World Economic Forum meetings and I'm speaking and moderating a bunch of different events. And within that, a lot of the themes that are coming through is this inclusive and equitable transition conversation and how that manifests around the world. So I have dusted off 2 books on my bookshelf, How Big Things Get Done and The Speed of Trust, because one of the things that I'm doing is setting up a couple conversations. And I just am reflecting back on some of your ESG comments, Amy, and just conversations that the three of us have had over the years at this point. And the idea that equity and inclusiveness and justice are add-ons or check the box or, you know, let's, you know, add up the points. No, it's actually like essential stuff if you want to get stuff done at scale very quickly. Relationships, trust, all of that. My colleague Diana Hernandez and I discussed this at length from the U.S. context. It applies in the global context as well. And so I just wanted to flag those 2 books because I've read them before. Y'all know I've talked about them, but I'm dusting them off again and kind of going through it, reading a couple new reports that have come out just in preparation for the meetings, which I think will be really interesting to happen at this time in this year about these topics.
Yeah, that does sound fascinating. Sorry, give me the titles of the 2 books again. So is it called How Big Things Get Done is one of them?
How Big Things Get Done. And then Speed of Trust, it's by Stephen Covey's son. So it's in the 7 Habits, but it's his son who wrote Speed of Trust. It's a really good book. And it just talks about, I mean, I quote Steph Spears all the time with Solstice, you know, things move at the speed of trust. That's how quickly they move. And these are actual real examples. So if you look at How Big Things Get Done, they talk about this database of thousands of mega projects, the big ones that we're talking about. And what is the difference between successful ones and not successful ones? Where are the differences? Speed of Trust, it's big projects, small projects, relationships, it's all kinds of things. But they're just really good. And they go back to the evidence and the data, which does not support the idea that we should treat equity and inclusiveness and justice as add-on check the box at the end of a process. But actually how they need to be integrated in from the beginning. And that is not to slow it down. That actually is to speed it up, which is something that I don't think is widely accepted, but it's where the evidence points us. And we can open up the layers of the onions and all the nuances of what I just said, but in terms of globally with all our different government structures, et cetera, moving quickly, this is essential stuff to understand.
Oh, those do sound great. I should definitely check both of those out. So my free electron is a much shorter read. It's a newspaper article I came across recently, and it's a piece from the New York Times from almost exactly 50 years ago today. It was published in May 1974 with the headline, Hydrogen, a Way Out of the Energy Crisis Mark. And it's just really fascinating reading it. Say, 50 years ago, so many of the debates are so familiar. The way people are talking about hydrogen at the moment, questions about sort of electrify everything versus using hydrogen for various applications where energy storage is inadequate and so on. And in one sense, then it's quite kind of depressing in that it makes you feel like time is a flat circle. You know, we're kind of stuck now 50 years on having a lot of those same old debates all over again. But in a lot of ways, I think it's actually not so depressing and kind of encouraging because it shows that we do actually understand a lot more about hydrogen and its true potential now than we did then. That article from 1974 talks about people using hydrogen in their homes for heating and cooking and so on, which I think is pretty well not anything nowadays that people are very seriously progressing. There have been a few pilots, but I think it's been pretty conclusively demonstrated that's not a great thing to be doing with hydrogen. And in particular, I think we now understand much better where are the really valuable applications of hydrogen for a lot of industrial processes, industrial heat and so on, maybe for energy storage as well. So we're advanced in some ways. And I think that discussion in 1974 was about sort of the hydrogen economy, about everything being hydrogen. I think nobody realistically thinks we're going to get to that point anymore, but it does still look like there could be a valuable role for hydrogen in certain targeted applications. So in some ways, we haven't made much progress. In some ways, we have made some significant progress. But as I say, it's a really interesting snapshot of history. I posted it on LinkedIn, also on Twitter, as I still insist on calling it. So do go and check that out if you're interested, because I think it's well worth a read. So unfortunately, we do have to leave it there. Many thanks, Melissa.
Thanks, Ed, Amy. Always good to chat. Always so many more things to discuss.
Many thanks, Amy.
Yes, looking forward to seeing you in the city soon, Melissa, after you've had your trip to the kingdom. And Ed, ditto.
Absolutely. And as Melissa says, we're going to need to get back together again very soon to talk about all the things we haven't had time to get to the bottom of on this show. Many thanks to our producers, Roxy Ebrahim-Khan, Toby Biggins-Gilchrist and Sam Nash. And above all, of course, many thanks to all of you for listening. As you know, we really value your feedback, so do please keep it coming. And we'll be back in 2 weeks with all the latest news and views on what I'm going to insist on continuing to call the energy transition. Until then, goodbye.